Well, good evening. Welcome to the fifth, or is it actually sixth, lecture in our series on American power in the 21st century. For those of you who are students here, let me say I'm extremely impressed that, given the time of year, examinations and so on, that you're still coming to public lectures. The LSE program this term has been incredibly impressive, with five or six excellent events a week almost. And I just want to let you know about one more. It, in fact, will be the final one in the Miliband series on American power, and it's on the 24th of June. It's Professor Eikenbury, and he's going to talk about America's unipolar order, liberal hegemony, or revisionist empire. He's been a consistent critic of the Bush administration and of the new foreign policy doctrine, the new security doctrine, and it will be an extremely impressive lecture. We've also asked a number of people to come and reply to him, and as soon as that program is fixed, it will be on the website. But the 24th of June should be in your diaries for the finale of this series. For those of you who don't know, and there's no reason why you should, the first set of series on economic globalization and global governance is now available in the bookshops, called Taming Globalization, Frontiers of Governance. And it contains the first six Miliband lectures from last year, which started with Joe Stiglitz, Robert Wade, John Ruggie, Bob Cohen, and others, and is, I think, an extremely succinct, well-argued critique, as it were, of the dominant neoliberal economic orthodoxy. So if you have nothing to read over the summer, and you're not going to just read novels as I am, you might go to the bookshop and take out, or to go to the library and take out a copy of Taming Globalization. It's a great pleasure this evening to welcome our speaker, who's flown in from Boston just yesterday, and is, of course, suffering a little bit of jet lag. He is Professor Sui, and he is currently at Harvard as a senior visiting fellow at Harvard Law School. His main position, or will in the future, be as professor and chairman of the Department of Political Science at Shanghai Jiao Tong University, in Shanghai itself. Did I get that right so far? Thank you very much. I was working on it. But he's a very interesting fellow, born in China, educated in China for most of his life, but he took an MA at the University of Chicago and a PhD at the University of Chicago, which he completed in 1995. So, very cosmopolitan intellectual figure. He has published widely over the years in both English and in Chinese. In English, most recently, he's written on the theme of sustainable democracy and on theory against fate. But his next really big publication will be next year, when Harvard University Press will publish Wrestling with the Invisible Hand, Soft Budget Constraints in the Capitalist Economy. His lecture tonight is The Bush Doctrine and American Neoconservatism, a Chinese view or perspective, and I'm certainly looking forward to it very much. So thank you. We know you're tired, but we will be a sympathetic audience.
Thank you for coming. Special thank you for Professor Held for your kind introduction. If I may, I would like to add one more point of self-introduction. Because Robin Blackburn is here, and the New Left Review in London has mentioned that my Chinese articles has been one of the representative writings in the Chinese New Left intellectual movement. So it is my special pleasure to be invited here to give Ralph Miliband lecture, since Ralph Miliband was one of the major figures in the British New Left movement. I am also honored by the presence of Marianne Kozak, Ralph Miliband's wife, today. Needless to say, my presentation should not be considered as anything other than my personal view about Chinese perspective on the Bush doctrine and the new conservative. In other words, it is in no way represented the official governmental view on this, but I will certainly survey the Chinese official view also. I'd like to start by saying that my lecture is not about. So it is not about, it's not a comprehensive survey of the China's foreign policy, nor is it an evaluation of China's domestic human rights policy and records. My task is rather limited. It is just a characterization of China's response to the ascendance of the so-called Bush doctrine and the new left and the new conservatives in the US. So the structure of my presentation is shown in the screen. So basically, I will first talk about a little bit about Bush doctrine and then about new conservatives' connection with Bush doctrine, and then the European response and the Chinese response by contrast with the European response. And then I will talk about geopolitical reasons for Chinese response and give most emphasis on the philosophical response, philosophical reasons for Chinese response for Bush doctrine. To highlight the essential features of the Chinese viewpoints, both by the government but also by the public opinion, in the sense that the Chinese intellectual have the relative autonomy, an increasing relative autonomy now, and especially the widespread of internet in China. You can find all opinions of all spectrum in China, so it makes sense also to talk about the public opinion in China. But in order to highlight the essential features of Chinese perspective, I adopt a strategy of presentation, what I called argument by contrast. So in explaining the domestic Chinese perspective of Bush doctrine, I contrast it with the dominant European perspective, exemplified by the German philosopher Habermas. In explaining the philosophical underpinnings of China's perspective, I contrast it to the democratic peace theory. It's a very famous, influential theory exemplified by Michael Doyle, who is a political theorist at Princeton University, and American officials, for example, Rumsfeld, in his speech, often mentioned democratic peace theory as a justification for the American war on Iraq, for example. The reason I use this strategy of argument by contrast is that from my personal experience, with my American friends, most of them are American liberals, I found them are very difficult to understand the Chinese perspective on international affairs. So by contrasting the Chinese view with the well-known the Chinese viewpoints, I hope to communicate Chinese view in a way easier to be understood. Just to begin back, I want to give an example. Like I find from my American liberal friends, the how difficult it was for them to understand the Chinese perspective. As you know, the Chinese embassy was bombed during the war in Yugoslavia. And not only the government, but most Chinese people, if you read the Chinese internet, and most intellectuals do not believe it was an accident. I mean, certainly there are a small number of Chinese intellectuals always followed American dominant opinion also, and also mostly interviewed by the New York Times reporters in China. Most frequently, I mean, there are small number of Chinese intellectuals believe in this is just an accident. But I think it's fair to say both the government and the majority of the Chinese students and intellectuals did not believe it was simply an accident. But I found my American friends, they are well-intentioned, they are liberal, they are not conservative in America, but they really cannot understand why most of the Chinese took this view. They think it's almost unbelievable, cannot understand. They think maybe Chinese people are crazy or just is overreaction, over suspicious. So, but in fact, most the Chinese people, because in the first Gulf War in the 1991, in the TV screen, and the Chinese military analyst commenting the first Gulf War in military history were very surprised, very impressed by the so-called revolution in military affairs and by the precedent weapons first used in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And one famous military commentary in Chinese TV said that these weapons was so precise, so if they want to hit a man's toilet, they will not hit woman's toilet. And most Chinese people really believe in that. And also, it was the point emphasized by the US newspapers and US visitors to Chinese universities, because they emphasized this so-called revolution in military affairs first time exemplified itself in the Gulf War. So you can imagine, given that widespread belief about the precision, so it's very hard, it's really difficult for them to, for Chinese people, common people, to believe that it was just an accident, or US military was simply incompetent, especially if you also reported by new US newspapers that the airplane to hit the Chinese embassy was not in the theater in the Yugoslavia, but is specially launched from the US mainland. It's a B-52 from US mainland launched specially for this. So, but I use this as an example to show how difficult it is to have a real mutual understanding between the US intellectuals, even liberal intellectuals, and what the common people in China think and believe. So that's why I want to use this contrast to present the Chinese view. By contrasting, I want to make a case of the reasonableness of the Chinese perspective. Saying Chinese, when I say Chinese view is reasonable, I mean it's not the same as saying that Chinese view is always correct or without internal tensions or even contradictions. But saying the Chinese view is reasonable does imply that the Western world should take Chinese view seriously in the hope that a real cosmopolitan democracy need a full intellectual inputs and the participation of the Chinese people and the people in the third world at large. So now I will go to my presentation. So I apologize in advance because I guess you may know more than me about the Bush doctrine, but I just mentioned it very briefly in order to talk about China. So the Bush doctrine is first officially presented by the Bush speech in the West Point in the June 1st, 2002, and most comprehensively represented by the publication in September 2002, the US National Security Strategy. Both of them are available from the White House website. And it has basically 3 points. And actually these 3 points was summarized by Robert Kagan, who was the earlier speaker in this lecture series. And so this first point is from the containment, the Cold War US grand strategy, from containment and deterrence to preemptive strike. And the second is this aggressive unilateralism to export democracy. This word export democracy is not in the Bush speech, but is Robert Kagan's summary. And the third is the US military supremacy beyond the challenge. And so how Bush doctrine is connected with new conservatism. Obviously, first Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz in 1992 wrote this defense planning guidance. And all the 3 points in the last slide has already been there in the Wolfrey's 1992 defense planning guidance. For example, Wolfrey's in 1992 said post-war US grand strategy should be that the other powers should make other powers do not even to think about to balance and challenge US dominance. And so that's why in many US newspapers, people use the Wolfrey's Bush doctrine. And in 1997, very interesting, because first President Bush, the older President Bush, did not accept Wolfrey's because his defense planning guidance was leaked to the New York Times, and that caused a big storm of controversy. And so the Bush didn't. Bush ordered, at that time, the Dick Cheney, not the vice president, but at the time, the Secretary of Defense, to rewrite Wolfrey's planning guidance. So during the Clinton administration, Wolfrey was the professor and the dean of the School of International Relations of Johns Hopkins University. And but in 1997, when all these people, Dick Cheney, Tom Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfrey, they were not in the Clinton government, but they set up a think tank called the New American Century. As you know, there are all the leading new conservatives, like William Crystal is the, as many of you, I'm sure you know, is the son of the leading American new conservative thinker, William Crystal, and the editor of Weekly Standard, the leading new conservative magazine, and Robert Kagan, who was the previous speaker here, who just recently published a book about conflict between US and Europe. And so that's the Bush doctrine and the connection with the new conservatives. And I think how do other parts of the world respond and react and analysis the Bush doctrine? I think in order to understand the Chinese, to highlight the essential features of Chinese viewpoints, it's easy if we compare it with the dominant European response. I think it's maybe reasonable and fair to consider Habermas as one of the representatives of European public opinion on the Bush doctrine. And that's the, in the June, 2 months ago, Habermas published an article and recently has been translated into English. So Habermas said, United States, with the Iraq war, gave up the role of a guarantor of the power in the international laws. With his violation thereof, she sets future superpowers a disastrous example. And then he said, let's not kid ourselves. America's normative authority lies shattered. But interestingly, on the NATO intervention in Kosovo and on the first Gulf War, Habermas was all supportive. So I think this quite representative of the dominant European intellectual's point of view, that mostly they supported NATO intervention in Kosovo, but were against this most recent war on Iraq. So this is Habermas actually gave a 3-point justification for the NATO intervention in the Kosovo. That's published in a new US news journal called Constellation. And he gave these 3 points justification. First, the NATO intervention in Kosovo is a prevention of ethnic cleansing. And second, amount to emergence assistance. And he referred to a clause in the international law saying that in emergency assistance, even without UN authorization, like there is no UN authorization either, in the NATO intervention in Kosovo, it still can be justified. And thirdly, Habermas referred to this implicitly democratic peace theory, saying that democratic and constitutional character of all the member states of the ad hoc military alliance justify the intervention in Kosovo. So it's a so basically, Kosovo intervention is justified on human rights ground, even without UN authorization. And the Chinese reaction to the Bush doctrine is, I think, can be essentially characterized by contrast with this European view represented by Habermas. Basically, the European public opinion emphasized the Bush doctrine is something really new, because that's why Habermas against the war on Iraq, but was support of war in first Gulf War and the Cold War. But China, I think both Chinese government and the majority of Chinese intellectuals and students emphasized the continuity of the Bush doctrine with Clinton's foreign policy, in contrast to Habermas. Just as I said, Habermas said earlier, the American normative authority lies shattered, but most Chinese people, the U.S. never had the normative authority Habermas talked about. But interestingly, so whether or not this Chinese view on the continuity between Clinton and Bush is reasonable, I think it's the crucial question I want to address. I think it's reasonable for several reasons. And first, actually the new conservatives themselves emphasize the continuity of their view with the Clinton. For example, the William Christou I mentioned earlier, the editor of Weekly Standard, in their book, co-authored with the senior editor of New Republic, mostly considered as a more pro-democrat publication in the US. But two of them wrote this book together, War Over Iraq, in which, I quote, "The Bush would hardly be acting without a president if he acted unilaterally against Saddam. After all, President Clinton resorted to force without UN approval on several occasions, each time receiving the support of Daschle and his fellow Democrats." And Lawrence Kaplan and William Christou especially emphasize, they cite Richard Holbrooke, Clinton's special envoy to the Yugoslavia. He's saying, I quote, "Act without the Security Council or don't act at all." So the new conservatives themselves emphasize the continuity. And also, I'd like to add two more examples. If we read Richard Holbrooke, the Clinton's envoy to Yugoslavia, his memo to stop a war, we can see that in his memo, he mentioned the story that Richard Perle, who is a very important new conservative guy, who I guess many of you know, close associated with Paul Wolfowitz, and was the chairman of the Defense Advisory Board for the U.S. Defense Department, and who was the third Assistant Secretary for Defense in the Reagan administration. And in Richard Perle's memo on Yugoslavia war, he mentioned that Richard Perle actually play a very important role in Holbrooke's mission, I will not say more, but simply recommend you, if you haven't read the memo on this part, the Perle has called Richard Holbrooke, gave his many advice, and also personally went to Kosovo to do the negotiation, and also Albert Wolfstetter, who is maybe the most important U.S. strategic analyst after George Kennan. For many years, he was the strategy analyst at the Rand Corporation. But interestingly, in the early 70s, he was at the University of Chicago's political science department. Albert Wolfstetter actually was the PhD dissertation advisor for Paul Wolfowitz, who got his PhD in political science at the University of Chicago in 1972. But Wolfstetter, during the Kosovo crisis, published many articles in the Wall Street journals urging the US intervention. So I think on the account of new conservatives themselves, it's not totally unreasonable to for Chinese to see the continuity of Clinton and the Bush administration. Even this doesn't mean China's intellectuals and the government deny the important difference, but China have more emphasis on the Bush doctrine as a continuation and a culmination and the most sophisticated and matured US grand strategy. So now I will go to the next part. So I will talk a little bit about what are the geopolitical reasons for China to see the continuity and the culmination of the US post the Bush doctrine. But first, China considers this as a culmination of US post-war search for a proper grand strategy. And so if we look at the leading democratic leaders, the view of US grand strategy, like Madeleine Albright, she said, "We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall. We see further into the future." And Brzezinski, who was a Democrat and also was the National Security Advisor to President Carter, he said, "To prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals," by vassal he means European allies, "and to keep barbarians from coming together." So that's the democratic strategic thinking. And but if you compare this with Ewan Christou, I said the father of William Christou, the most influential philosopher of new conservatives, and President George W. Bush just recently gave Ewan Christou the President's Medal of Freedom, is the highest honor for given by the U.S. President. And Ewan Christou said in an article in 1987 that, I quote, "One of these days, the American people are coming to awaken to the fact that we have become an imperial nation, even though the public opinion and all of our political tradition are hostile to the idea. It is no winning ambition on our part that has defined our destiny in this way, nor is it any kind of conspiracy by a foreign policy elite. It happened because the world wanted it to happen, needed it to happen, and signaled this need by a long series of relatively minor crises that could not be resolved except by some American involvement." So basically, you can see the continuity between Christou's thinking about the necessity of US empire with like Madeleine Albright and Brzezinski, I said earlier. And maybe one, the only difference is that Ewan Christou is much more explicit and frank. And actually, there is this modern Chinese tradition. Actually, like if you go back to Mao Zedong, when he opened the dialogue with the Richard Nixon, and he said, actually, "I like to talk with American right-wing people because he think American right-wing are more frank and less deceptive as American liberals." As I said, actually, the American liberals was quite frank too. So China, from the geopolitical regions, cannot help but perceiving the US move, the Bush doctrine, as a culmination of the US, this whole post-war US imperial strategy. But one interesting thing, the first principle of preventive strike actually has a lot of debate in the United States. Many American political science and strategic thinkers actually disagree with preventive strike as a proper response, as a major grand strategy for US. For example, the this leading historian of the Cold War, at Yale University. Anyway, so sorry about the jet lag, the name just slipped me. But basically his argument is that the preventive strike is reasonable against like a terrorist, because terrorists are not rational. They are not rational, so containment and deterrence do not work on terrorists if you know where are they. So preventive strike is justified in attacking terrorists. However, in the Bush doctrine and the U.S. national strategy, national security strategy, make explicitly they connect the terrorist and the tyrant, and also dictatorship and authoritarian regime and the terrorist, they are connected together. And this was challenged by many American strategic thinkers, because the logic of containment and deterrence could still work in the case of tyrant and authoritarian, because tyrants are still rational in the sense they want their own survival. So the deterrence should still work. But one point I want to emphasize is that in the old United States like newspapers that I have read in the last couple of months, I did not see any mention about the preventive strike actually is the tardy force of the imperial strategy. It goes back to the Roman Empire, because basically the Roman Empire, actually in the later Roman Republic, the whole Roman Empire's territories were already occupied in the later Roman Republic. So it's not the case that Roman Empire, during the Empire period, really expanded their territory. It was in the Republican period, Roman Empire, the Roman Republic got almost all the territory already. And the major theorist of the later Republican period of Rome certainly is Cicero. And he emphasized very explicitly the preventive strike is the dominant strategy of the Roman Republic, in the later Roman Republic. Cicero said, quote, "How can you believe that the man who has lived so licentiously up to the present time will not proceed to every extreme of insolence if he shall also secure the authority given by arms? Do not then wait until you have suffered some such treatment and then rue it, but be on your guard before you suffer, for it is rash to allow dangers to come upon you and then to repent of it when you might have anticipated them." And war in the later Roman Republic, like the war on the Macedonia, is basically a preventive strategy by the Roman Senate. As I think many of you know more than me about the Roman history, because the kingdom of Syria and the kingdom of Macedonia made an alliance. Actually, their intention was against Egypt, but the Roman Senate said that this alliance was aimed at Rome, so they implement this preventive strike against Macedonia. And so, as I said, so majority of Chinese intellectuals consider this continuity from Clinton and Bush, this post-Cold War search for U.S. grand strategy. So for geopolitical reasons, I think China has attempted very limited counterbalancing effort. Because according to one of the big puzzles in the geopolitical strategy in today's world actually is the lack of counterbalancing by other major powers against, not in the sense of military attack, but in the sense just the balancing, counterbalancing the U.S. dominance. And this was a puzzle if many of you have learned this realist theory, structural realist theory by Watts, Keynes Watts. And basically the balance of power theory is that when you have a unipower, the other powers will come together to counterbalance this unipolar power. But so far, even though there is a limited effort by the other powers, but for example, the talk between China and Russia on this strategic partnership between China and Russia was quite hard-hearted. But limited as it is, I think we can still identify some counterbalancing move by China. First is China's using of his veto power in the UN Security Council. I will go to there in a minute. And the second is supporting euro by diversifying China's foreign currency holdings. And the third is developing Asian trade and monetary cooperation. And the fourth is developing trade and security cooperation with Russia and other Central Asian countries, the so-called Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the Shanghai Six. We can see that, we can see that, for example, in the Chinese voting behavior during the first Gulf crisis in the 1990s. So China voted in favor of the first 11 UN resolutions that condemned the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. But however, China abstained on the 12th so-called resolution 678 of the November 29, 1990, which from the US point of view was historic, as it sets the deadline for Iraqi withdrawal and authorize UN member nation to adopt the measures necessary to restore peace in the region if Iraq fail to meet the deadline. And the Chinese foreign minister at that time, Qian Qichen, explained why China abstained in the 12th resolution. The first, the resolution runs counter to the consistent position of the Chinese government, namely to try our utmost to seek a peaceful solution. Second, UN as an international organization for the maintenance of peace and security should act with great caution and avoid taking hasty actions on such a major question as authorizing some member states to take a military action against another member state. So we can see that in the first Gulf crisis, that's a major UN decision in the post-Cold War, because Cold War ended in 89, the end of 1990. China did not fully support the US-led intervention in the first Gulf War. And then we can see the UN Security Council resolution veto records, and all the five major powers in the Security Council, and like USSR, I mean today's Russia, has used the veto power 120 times, and the US has used the veto power 76 times, and the UK 32 times, France 18 times, China has used it 5 times, and one of the two last times is in 1999, China blocked the extension of the mandate of United Nations preventive deployment force in Macedonia, and in 1997 blocked the sending of 155 UN observers to Guatemala to verify a ceasefire. These two last veto, actually the Communist China only used the veto three times. The first two times were used by the nationalist government in Taiwan. When 1971, the Communist government took over the seats of Chinese seat in UN. So the Communist government in China only vetoed in the Security Council 3 times. And 2 recent times, both related to this Macedonian extension of UN preventive deployment force, and in the Guatemala, in both in 1999 were because these two, Macedonia and Guatemala, tried to establish diplomatic relationship with Taiwan. So actually many in the US and the West newspapers criticize Chinese position in these two vetoes, saying that this is national selfish. It's national selfish because if China did not block extension of UN preventive force in Macedonia in the February of 1999, maybe NATO would have no justification to bring more force, because the extension of UN force in Macedonia will prevent the beginning of this humanitarian crisis, this uncontrolled war refugees. And we can say more about that if we want during the discussion. But I just want to simply point out this national selfish actually, if you see this veto record, you can observe this behavior in almost all 5 powers. For example, UK and France, the veto powers are crucially related to the UN resolution against the Suez crisis. The US in the 76 vetoes by US, 35 US vetoed 35 resolution because it criticized Israel. I think it's quite revealing to see this veto records of all 5 powers. But now I will go to the last point of my presentation, is the philosophical reasons for China to think Bush doctrine actually has a continuity with the Clinton the foreign policy. The first, the new conservative share with the liberals the vision of US as a redeemer nation with a special providence. And the second, both Bush and Clinton based their foreign policy on the theory of democratic peace and human rights is higher than the national sovereignty. And China, I think both official position as well as the majority of intellectuals are against, for philosophical reasons, these two US position, namely the, against this democratic peace theory and human rights is higher than national sovereignty. And I will say a little bit to end my presentation about why. But first I would like to say, it's not unreasonable to think that the so-called US new conservative actually is in continuity with the US liberals on the US special providence to redeem the whole world. Because that's why I think it's very important to make a notice that so-called conservative part in the new conservative is very different from the conservative in the UK, for example. And one of the interesting anecdotes I want to share with you is that actually in the 1956, when the Irwin Kristol, as the father of the US New Conservative, was the editor in a journal called Encounter in London. And he came to London to edit this first major post-war US conservative journal. And Michael Oldershock, everyone I think knows him in the LSE, sent him a paper to be published in this journal, Encounter, called What is Conservative? But Irwin Kristol, after carefully reading it, reject this article, and he explained why he reject Michael Aldershot, where he said that's in his memoirs, autobiography of New Conservative. He said, he quote Michael Aldershot. So Aldershot said, what is esteemed in the conservative view, what is esteemed is the present, and it is esteemed not on account of his connection with the remote antiquity, nor because it is recognized to be more admirable than any possible alternative, but on account of his familiarity. To be conservative, then, is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, to prefer the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the limited to the unbounded, the near to the distant, the convenient to the perfect, the present laughter to utopian bliss. And then Yuen Crystal explained why he disagreed with Aldershot on this. He said, I quote, Aldershot is irredeemably secular as I, meaning Yuen Crystal. Being a Jewish conservative, I'm not. It is impossible for any religious person to have the kinds of attitude toward the past and the future that Aldershot's conservative disposition celebrates. Our scripture and our daily prayer book link us to the past and to the future with an intensity lacking in Aldershot's vision. I think this is very revealing. It shows U.S. new conservative actually is rather revolutionary. Yuen Crystal said very clearly he disagreed with Michael Aldershot's conservative disposition for the religious reasons. And it's not an accident, I think. Junior Bush, George W. Bush, win his presidency, largely he defeated Senator McCain from state of Arizona, mainly because Bush's religious credentials, he converted to Southern Protestant fundamentalism at the age of 40. And because the Southern, in the U.S. South, actually the Southern Protestant fundamentalism has took over the Republican convention, because this religious, especially in the U.S. South, the most widespread organization is called the Christian Coalition, and Bush has asked the head of Enron, because I heard the crisis and the scandal of Enron Corporation, because the Enron actually was the major campaign contributors to Bush, both old and junior Bush's election, and Bush has arranged for the Christian Coalition's second most senior leader to be on the Enron Corporation's high-paid advisory board. And so if we can see this religious fundamentalist connection of U.S. New Conservative, we can see it's very different from the British conservative tradition represented by Aldershot, and shares with American liberals and this forward-looking and the redeemer of the world. In fact, there is an article published by New Republic, as I mentioned earlier, the Democratic Journal. The title is that Bush as a closet liberal. And lastly, I think I have to finish. And as the most fundamental reason, I think China disagree with U.S. this philosophical reason is that China does not agree with this authority of human rights is higher than the authority of national sovereignty, which used in the NATO war against NATO intervention in Kosovo, but particularly justified by Michael Doyle's democratic peace theory. By saying that, I do not mean to imply that China both government and the majority of intellectuals think national sovereignty is higher than human rights. Rather, I mean that China actually want to articulate, but still unable to articulate a view that the question of human rights and national sovereignty should be reformulated, not formulated in the way in the democratic peace theory. So I just take a few minutes to explain why. So Michael Doyle's democratic peace theory basically has three basic elements. So first, he said liberal states do maintain peace among themselves. Well, this republic would engage in wars with non-republic. And then this institutional features lead to caution, since the consent of a citizen is required. So that's why, because consent is required, so democratic republic tend not to go to war, especially with other democratic republic. And thirdly, the very factors that promote peace among liberal states promote war with non-liberal states. That's his, and he claimed that his democratic peace theory comes from Kant's famous German philosopher, Kant's perpetual peace. But I think it's important to really read what Kant has to say about his perpetual peace thesis. So I quote from Kant. The consent of the citizens is required to decide whether or not war is to be declared. It is very natural that we will have the great hesitation in embarking on so dangerous an enterprise, for this would mean calling down on themselves all the miseries of the war, such as doing the fighting themselves, having to take upon themselves a burden of debt, I mean the public debt, which will embitter peace itself and which can never be paid off on account of constant threat of new wars. But I think if we really read Kant, this perpetual peace thesis carefully, Kant actually says something different from different from Michael Doyle's theory, because so Kant basically argues that why the democratic country are reluctant to go to war is because the citizens themselves would have to fight, and they naturally don't want to go to fight. Also, they worried about the burden of public debt. But first, we should notice that in Kant's original formulation, the democratic peace thesis says nothing about say nothing particular or special about democratic citizens' attitude toward a non-democratic state, because regardless the other states is democratic or not democratic, the citizens in a democratic state should always be reluctant to go to war. Not only, unlike Michael Doyle, because Michael Doyle said liberal state do maintain peace among themselves. It's a separate peace. If you remember during the First World War, so-called Russia, Soviet Union made a sacred peace with Germany, the separate peace. You use this analogy. So Michael Doyle's argument that is a democratic country themselves have a separate peace, but democratic country would be willing to go to war against non-democratic countries. But we cannot find this thesis in Kant's own formulation, because Kant's this argument apply this reluctance to go to war, if they have to fight by the citizens themselves, apply both to democratic enemy and a non-democratic enemy. And secondly, so first, I think it's reasonable to challenge Michael Doyle's explanation the correctness of his explanation of Kant. But secondly, we can see the many other complications in Kant's own formulation. So first, because Kant assumed the democratic citizens do not want war because they have to fight themselves. But in fact, because Kant wrote in the late 18th century, at that time, maybe the professional army already exists in Prussia, but But we see the professional armies become stronger and stronger in all the major countries. So it is not true that citizens of democratic country have to go to war themselves. They can have professional armies to fight. And the first reason, so Kant used to support his thesis, may no longer hold. But more importantly, since this is a lecture in memory of Ralph Miliband, we should have some kind of class analysis. As recently even pointed by the New York Times, the class structure of US Army are almost completely consist of the poor people and the low middle class people. Those people has no hope for the social mobility, upward mobility, and they see joining the army as their only way to move up, because they can learn some skill and even get, for the foreigners, the many foreigners for fighting in the US Army for the hope to get a green card or your American citizenship. So the Kant's reason has been further eroded by this class structure of the military today. But secondly, the Kant argued that the burden of public debt will make a democratic citizen reluctant to go to war. However, it's particularly related to China because most of US public debt are subscribed by foreign countries. Actually, China now becomes second largest foreign subscribers of US public debt, because China has, due to the big success of Chinese export, China has huge reserve of foreign currencies. And as I said, the majority of them still has been used to buy US treasury bond. But after the euro became into existence in 1997, China certainly, as a move to counterbalance, has diversified their foreign reserve by buying the euro. But the US are still the major part. But anyway, because this is a national secret in China, you cannot get exact figures. But according to the US publication, even also without the exact figure, but the US lists China as the number two in foreign countries buying the US treasury bond, the number one being Japanese. So it's not unreasonable for China at least have some doubt about perpetual peace thesis. But more fundamentally, I think Michael Doi has missed another major argument by Kant. Because Kant, actually, if you read his book, especially this new edition, Kant's Political Writings, it's a new translation published by Cambridge University Press in 1991. It's very clearly that Kant has another argument for perpetual peace, which he called transcendental argument, or the a priori argument. So basically, this transcendental argument is that basically by definition, that a republic understood that every citizen really participates in decision will lead to perpetual peace. But he made it clear this is a transcendental, almost definitional matter. It's an ideal to be approached through gradual reform. No any existing countries can be, this transcendental and a priori argument cannot be tested by empirical evidence, by the very nature of the argument. It's very interesting. I quote Kant said that actually many elements of Frederick the Great's rule accorded with the spirit of the representative system. So basically he means that this democratic peace is a transcendental or priori argument, is ideal to be approached. And in real state, if we just look at their formal constitution, cannot prove or disapprove his transcendental argument, because he gave the example, Prussia at Frederick the Great has no republican constitution. However, Kant believed it accord with the spirit of representative system. And And today we can argue that in today's formal constitutional democratic country, for example, like in the US, or even, maybe even better is in UK. No, like the British Parliament has just launched investigation whether or not Tony Blair has misled the British public about the existence of weapons of mass destruction. So these real existing democratic, formal democratic countries cannot, according to in Kant's own account, cannot prove or disapprove his thesis. I think I really have to finish. I argue that sort of for China to disagree with this perpetual peace, I forgot to mention, because this perpetual peace thesis, according to Michael Doi, directly related to the human rights is higher than sovereignty. Because I quote Michael Doi, I didn't get him to put on the screen, is that Michael Doi said, respecting on non-liberal states, the state rights to non-intervention requires ignoring the violations of rights they inflict on their own population. But Kant, in his, because in Kant, original article has five theses, in his fifth thesis, Kant argued explicitly against intervention in another country's domestic affairs. But certainly we can argue that what happens if the other country's government committed genocide? And Kant, actually, I think, has a good argument about that. We can talk about it in the discussion if you like. But the most essential point I want, this democratic peace theory is about this separate peace among liberal democratic states and intervention about non-liberal democratic states. So this basically is a division of the state in today's globe by their social institutions and ideological orientations. But this is fundamentally in contradiction to China's this most basic principle for Chinese foreign policy, the so-called five principles of peaceful coexistence. But this principle, I think, should deserve to be taken seriously, exactly because this principle, this five principle argue that we should not divide the, base the foreign policy on the basis of their social institutions and ideologies. So this principle first proposed by later Chinese Prime Minister Zhou Enlai when he met with the Indian delegation in December 1953. So it's the very beginning of the founding of Republic of China, People's Republic of China. And in the first Asian-African conference, the Bandung Conference, held in April 1955, Zhou Enlai reiterated these principles, and the spirit of which was incorporated into the declaration of the conference, the Bandung Conference. And in 1992, the Chinese Constitution, still valid today, has written this five principles of peaceful coexistence into the Chinese Constitution. So first, the five principles, first, the mutual respect for the sovereignty and the territorial integrity, and the second, the mutual non-aggression, and third, non-interference in each other's internal affairs, equality of and the mutual benefit, and fifth, the peaceful coexistence. And the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs explained these five principles in their official website, and I think it was reading that both, I quote, both history and the current international developments since World War II have shown that practice of defending friends and enemy according to difference in social system and value through forming camps, groups, and a big family and alliance invariably failed. So, what I want to stress exactly this point that the Chinese foreign policy does not define friends and enemy according to difference in social system and values through forming camps, groups, and a big family and alliance. This is exactly in contrast with this democratic peace theory, which is exactly about this separate peace about liberal democratic states. But I want to finish by saying that just refer to what I said earlier in the beginning of lecture, that what I say, the Chinese point of view is reasonable. I do not mean Chinese view is always correct or without internal tensions and even contradictions, but I just mean they are reasonable and deserve to be considered. I like to conclude by saying that actually I think the Chinese, both government and intellectual, has failed so far to really articulate their view, their reasonable forcefully, and in an intellectually exciting and respectable way. And I like to conclude by reflecting Franz Fanon, who is a very important thinker against the French war in Algeria. I quote, he said, "If we wish to turn Africa into a new Europe, then let us leave the destiny of our country to Europeans. They will know how to do it better than the most gifted among us." So I think Franz Fanon asked a fundamental question for all the third world countries, which still has not been answered today. So basically, so what's the point to have an independent country for the third world? Because if third world country only just want to copy the Western civilization, it is better to let the Western colonialists to continue their rule because they knew how to do it better than the most gifted among us. So Fanon actually implies, I don't think he implies that the third world countries should not learn the good elements in Western civilization, but he emphasizes rather on the search for the real innovation, which combines the elements, the good elements, both in the West and in the third world countries, to bring up the progress of humanity to a higher level. And his hope and vision still has to be discussed and in today's world, and we still do not have a good answer for his question. What's the point of independence? And I think even though Chinese government and intellectuals has their view are reasonable, but I do not think they articulate it well enough. And actually, it's my hope to contribute to this articulation when I return to China. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for absolutely fascinating lecture. I've recently spent time both in the United States and China, and I did not until now have such a strong sense of the historical generation of the differences that are being expressed in current political terms. Now, I think there's some interesting paradoxes to what you said. It could be that one of them could be that China is paradoxically the best representative now of the Kantian doctrine on Earth. Another thesis you seem to be suggesting is that Chinese foreign policy is closer to the heart of liberal multilateralism than any U.S. administration since 1945. I mean, that may not be what you wanted to imply, but I took the thrust of your argument to suggest that it's actually in the heart of the Chinese understanding of foreign policy that we find premises consistent with, as it were, the principles of liberal multilateralism and liberal institution building since 1945, but we find in Clinton to Bush a systematic departure from that, and there's continuity there which should not surprise us. Yes, it's a very interesting argument and a very provocative one. Before I pick it up, I'm sure other people in the audience would want to. So we usually take questions in twos and threes and fours, so let's see where we are. Audience. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks very much. I would like to ask if, a few things, a few comments as well. The religious point of view, which you very briefly touched on, don't you agree that possibly the major difference between China and the United States is that China traditionally is not, let's call it, a Christian country, and that all Christian countries throughout 2,000 years of Christianity have always been, let's face it, this agenda of expansion and mission and everything, and hence, let's face it, apartheid was equally justified by the Bible as George Bush's policy nowadays, presumably. And do you think that is one of the main factors rather than anything else? Hence bringing the kind of value to the human rights rather than national integrity, posting this kind of Christian values over the integrity of a country. Don't you think this is like the main driving force rather than anything else? And don't you think that the American foreign policy has been like, say that way, expansionist, not just since the Clinton administration, but basically for, over 100 years possibly, with the war against Mexico, as far as I remember, which was an aggression by the United States, war against Spain involving that, don't you think that this is a possibly even longer tradition than just the Clinton administration? Thanks.
Thank you. Wait.
you spoke about Chinese foreign policy and how China has adopted in part the euro as a counterbalance to the United States. US dollar. One of the main tenets of Chinese foreign policy is also multipolarity in world affairs, which means that it would be better to have many world powers. In this context, you analyzed the United States, you took into consideration Russia and Shanghai Six. I would like to ask you, what would be the place in this picture for Europe and the European Union? In the Chinese view?
Good question. Yeah, back there. Yeah.
Actually, I just followed his question. That's a really good question, the second one. Under the previous Chinese reform leader, Deng Xiaoping, he loves play bridge. And when he played bridge, he always said there are three big players in this world, America, China, and Russia. That was the case before the Cold War finished. So follow this question, all this triangle framework will be replaced by the EU, which means the Sino-US relationship, and at the same time, EU will be the one to balance this kind of struggle for the power. So that's, I would like to know your opinion.
I wanted to ask the future cooperation between Europe and China, because Europe, or better to say France and Germany, and Russia opposed the intervention in Iraq, but because it was nearly already questioned, I would say, how is China seeing Europe as the European Union, because it doesn't exist in the foreign common foreign security policy, because the United Kingdom were in favor for the intervention in Iraq. How is China seeing the European Union because it was split in different opinions, let us say, about the intervention in Iraq.
Yeah, Robert. You okay?
Yes, Robert. I wanted to ask, you gave some very interesting data about the use by the different powers of their veto rights on the Security Council. And it was, of course, very notable that China had made very little use of that veto right, whereas the others had made quite a bit. My question is this. Actually, China's policy on the Security Council has therefore been not to strongly oppose US policy, but rather it will abstain, but it doesn't use its veto rights. And in the recent conflict over in the Security Council over Iraq, it didn't seem to be China that was leading the way. France, perhaps, or some other members of the Security Council. So what is the explanation for the very great moderation of China when it comes to opposing the United States? And is there a problem that China is very dependent on the US market, perhaps? That's a rather crude reason, but it would be one could think of. And is there not an anxiety in China to be thought well of by the United States, by Washington, by official US opinion? We read in the press that Chinese new leaders, at least in the past, maybe not the new leader, but who first went to Russia, but in the past, going to the United States seems to be an extremely important symbolic and substantive thing when Jiang Zemin went, for example.
Do you want to take this?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for all those interesting and challenging questions. So the first question is about Western Christian tradition and the difference between China in the religious tradition, and whether or not Western Christian tradition explains a lot the right. I agree with you, and actually I thought to develop more in my talk about this Western Christian tradition and the importance of the human rights that originated from the concept of natural rights. And the certain concept of natural rights has a complicated origin, but importantly has this religious origin in the Thomas Aquinas notion about natural rights is a reason embodied in the eternal law, eternal law of God. And in the whole Western colonial history, the notion of natural rights was closely associated with the imperialism and colonialism. But this does not mean, I'm not rejecting the notion of human rights and human rights. I'm not saying that it cannot be reinterpreted in a fruitful way in today's world, but I think it was a fact worth remembering that the human rights originated in the notion of natural rights was extremely important conceptual tool to legitimize the Western domination of the other parts of the world. Like one of the most interesting justification used by both Spanish and Grotius and even John Locke is that the Native Americans, they violated the natural rights because the natural right given by the eternal law of God means you should not do hunting. You should always growing your land, right, to make agriculture. And if you do hunting, it's a violation of natural law. Therefore, justify the termination of the American Indians. And I mean, this today sounds maybe sounds almost too ridiculous argument, but in fact, this was the major argument. If you read this very interesting book by the former professor in the Cambridge University, Richard Tark, his book, Theory of War and Peace, is basically a study of the notion of human rights and natural rights in the Western colonial history. But having said that, I think human rights after the French Revolution can be reinterpreted in a fruitful way. And what I said earlier, I do not mean to say that sovereignty is higher than, I just mean to say we should search for a new formulation about human rights and sovereignty, not who is heir than whom, and taking into account all the complicated history. The second question about Europe, and I think the second and third question are the same, basically about Europe in the Chinese foreign policy and the Chinese support of the European currency. I think there is an increasing awareness among the Chinese leadership and the Chinese intellectuals and the strategic thinkers about the extremely importance of the formation of European Union. And I think in the early 80s and early 90s, and because China at that time was in the early stage of opening to the outside world, and China was completely absorbed by the excitement of visiting US, and many Chinese intellectuals and leaders, I mean, visit the US, and so they all they know about the West, it seems to be US. But increasingly, China has granted the important role of Europe and in the Chinese foreign policy, especially we can see that by the high level attendance of the Europe-Asia meeting, and also the increasing number of publications of about European economy and European polity in the Chinese newspapers and in the publishing house. This important Chinese diversification of foreign currency holding, I think, as I said, we do not know the exact figure, but I think it's extremely important. As you know that, actually, many of today's crisis with Iraq had something to do with what should be the currency used to buy the oil. Because in the first oil crisis in 1973, at that time, Saudi Arabia decided when they sell their oil, they would not accept US dollar. That's in 73. And the US Treasury Secretary at that time was named William Simon, who was actually was a leading new conservative, now passed away, but actually William Simon was many of the, after he retired from Treasury Secretary, he founded many new conservative think tanks like William Crystal and their early newspaper and many publications were founded by through the connection William Simon. William Simon is very important because of his strategy of dealing with the first oil crisis. Because Saudi Arabia at that time supported the important IMF reform in the early 70s. But at that moment, IMF, there was a proposal to reform IMF to really make use the so-called special drawing right as an international currency rather than depend on totally the US dollars. Because IMF, from the very founding, very beginning until now, used the special drawing right as an internal currency within IMF accounting, but has never been really used in the international transactions, in the real business transactions. But there was a proposal of using that to counter the dominance of US dollar. And Saudi Arabia said, we decided to only receive special drawing right. And William Simon was very worried, and he visited Saudi Arabia and promised to give more special military aid and weaponry sale, but particularly through a secret agreement with the Saudi government to allow Saudi government to use US dollar, to use their so-called recycled dollar, US dollar, to buy US treasury bond with a secret discount, beneficial discount rate. Because usually we know the treasury bond should be buy through the public auctions. But William Simon arranged for the Saudi Arabia has this beneficial secret buy, and this has been recently documented in an important book published by Cornell University Press about this first oil crisis and the international this monetary reform idea of a special drawing right. So I think China was aware of it recently, and has shifted their foreign currency holding to support the euro. And about the third question, I think it's Robin Blackburn's question about Chinese use of veto power in the Security Council. I think you are right that China has used, in comparison to other countries,
has used veto power only 3 times in the communist China, right? And the last 2 times they use the veto because try to not allow other countries to have formal diplomatic relationships with Taiwan. And I think that the reason was not that China is not mainly because China wants US market. But I think it's true in the Jiang Zemin's, now the current leader is the party secretary Hu Jintao, but in the Jiang Zemin's period, at least in the beginning and the middle period of Jiang Zemin's leadership, I think they interpret this Deng Xiaoping's slogan that, I mean, Deng Xiaoping's idea that China, I can't think about this proper translation, but called Tao Guang Yang Hui. Maybe someone can help me to translate. Basically, Deng Xiaoping had said that China should not outspoken, should not be outspoken, should not be the leader in the international affairs. Rather, China should keep low key and to concentrate on the economic, domestic economic development. But, and I think in the early and middle period of Jiang Zemin's leadership, and many intellectuals surrounding him maybe have a kind of simplified understanding and interpretation of this Deng Xiaoping's strategy, or this low-key strategy, because they seems not to really study the Western history of political economy and national security, because economic development and national security can never be separated. And in fact, military modernization, like for example in the US during the New Deal and the Second World War, was extremely important for the modernization of the US economy. So I think more and more people gradually in the late 90s in China realized the importance to think about the connection between political economy and national security. And it seems that the new leadership of Hu Jintao has a slightly, I'm not expressing any official view, but it seems my impression is that the new leadership has a slightly different take, both in Chinese foreign policy and the domestic policy. In a sense, also in Chinese domestic policy, the new leadership has paid much more attention to the increasing inequality among Chinese population, among different Chinese regions, than the earlier leadership. So China is in a moment of, it's a very important moment. There is a shift in the policy orientation, I think, both in domestic and international arena. But gradually, it's a gradual shift. It's not, it's an experimental and search, but it's not a sudden or big shift. Okay. Thank you.
Well, we are running out of time. It's nearly 8 o'clock. Anybody got a burning desire to ask a short question? A burning desire. You'll be judged by the accordingly. Two really short questions here, and then you're only allowed a few seconds for each one.
Okay. The 5 points to peace that you put on the screen earlier, and also your reply to the previous question about why China doesn't use its veto. It sounds, pardon me if I'm being a bit cynical here, but it sounds as if your policy is a little isolationist, and that the 5 points support the view that if you don't interfere with other states, they won't interfere with you or your policies. It does sound a little bit like that. Is that the case or not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask what the relationship between China and Japan is. Certainly Japan was, Bush sort of thought, was going to have a bigger role for Japan in terms of pushing the American agenda in East Asia, and I think the Japanese sort of resisted. They didn't want to be a stooge, I guess. Can you sort of comment on that?
And just very, anyone else? Yeah, very short.
Thank you. I just picked on to our speaker's last comment. He made a very interesting point that the new leadership seems to have kind of a shift in terms of the domestic and foreign policies. And encouragingly, he said, Mr. Wu seems to be, there seems to be some shift to give more attention to the growing inequalities within China. Can you expand this a bit? Because what are the implications insofar as foreign relations are concerned? I think many people have wishful thinking to expect China to challenge the US at least right away. I don't know how you see China going if there's an increasing concern about inequality within China. Would it affect it even moving closer to the American position of cooperating with them in some way? Thank you.
And I just have a couple of short questions of my own. One is, just very quickly, do the Chinese see the UK and the UK's role in the recent war as, you know, to use the metaphors of dogs that are popular, as poodle to the USA, lost bulldog, or just a stray, I mean, in the world? I mean, how does China, is it that we are in Europe or not in Europe, in the US, not in the US? I'd be interested to know your inflection. Secondly, what is the Chinese position on the ICC and why? And what does that tell us about the overall Chinese view with respect to human rights, the proper limits to diversity of political constitutions that are recognized in the constitution of the ICC with respect to crimes against humanity, genocide, and so on? And if you could just reflect on that, because the ICC seems to me quite indicative of how one approaches these wider questions of human rights and whether human rights and sovereignty constrain each other, and if so, how.
Okay. Thank you. And you said
very short.
Very short.
Five questions, 5 minutes.
And I think maybe starting from the last question, first, UK's role, I think China, most people think UK as a junior partner. But the very fact that the Labour government of Tony Blair supported Bush, I think further support, China, I think is further justification of their view to see the continuity between Clinton and Bush, because they basically see Tony Blair and Clinton are similar. And about the role of ICC, the International Criminal Court, I think China is in supportive of International Criminal Court. In this regard, China is different from US, because US withdrew from International Criminal Court. U.S. does not recognize authority. I think China tend to agree, at least agree with that. And because I think Chinese view is not that genocide, human rights violation is not important, but crucially for China is who has the right to identify and solve the genocide, the human rights problem. And as long as China think UN should be the final international arbitrator to deal with that. And so as long as the UN is in charge, certainly I think China has, for the last 7 years, has participated in the international peacekeeping in Indonesia, but also in Kosovo. Today also they have, China has 55 policemen participate in international peacekeeping in Indonesia and also in Kosovo today still. And also China has this weapon inspectors in Iraq. Actually, one of the Chinese weapon inspectors in Iraq was killed in the end of the inspection process. And the question about the starting the backward sequence, the question about internal inequality, and I think this is cut both ways. I think it's no simple answer to that. But I think the pay attention to the internal income inequality across regions and also across different social strata, social classes in China, implies that China would develop and rely more on the development of their domestic market, and most importantly, to investment in the infrastructure in the western region of China, and thereby to increase the domestic demand by leveling the income differences, so make domestic purchasing power bigger. So China will become less dependent on the foreign market. And but this does not mean China will not continue the open door policy. But as Keynes always said, the openness is very important. But what is really important about openness is the exchange of ideas, art, science. But whether or not openness must imply the inter-border international capital flow or not is a secondary question, is a technical question. Maybe we need more open international capital flow, maybe not. But what's the point of openness? Is the exchange of ideas, the culture, science. And I think this has been, so China would not, certainly will not, and cannot, should not stop the open door policy, of course, in this, I mean, the Keynes sense. And the question of, sorry, I kind of forgot your question. Oh, I see. Right. I think, as I said, in the end, I didn't get time to develop. I think your important element of truth in your impression, because I think I argue the Chinese view is a reasonable view, but I am personally not satisfied with, because they do not have an articulate theoretical argument for their, with, so in practice, they, in many cases, they tend to be like isolationist, as you said, and sorry, your question? Sorry, I kind of forgot too.
That was the China-Japan question.
Oh, China-Japan, yes. I mean, of course,
30 seconds.
The main problem is with Japan is a kind of delicate, and I think more and more people in China value the positive relation and the improved relation with Japan, but under the conditions that Japan should openly apologize for that, because they argue that why Germany can do that, and Japan cannot do it. So that's, especially Japan has officially apologized to Korea. But China, not, because it's an interesting shift, because in the beginning, the first Asian financial crisis in the 1997, when Japan proposed the Asian Monetary Fund for the first time, China followed the US position, object the Japanese proposal. So both US and China object Japan. The proposal, but later on, actually China agreed with second proposal of Japan to set up Asian Monetary Fund, but still the second time also been turned down by International Monetary Fund. But I think there was an interesting shift in this view toward this Asian Monetary Fund. But the last point I want to say that about the UK, actually I think China still see the difference between UK and US because this month or last month, the UK has established a formal diplomatic relationships with North Korea, right? It's in last month or this month? Last month, yes. And I think China certainly view this UK's diplomatic recognition of North Korea as a positive move. I think in a way, if we use the jargon of international relations theory, to think about Chinese, this five principle of coexistence, maybe can be interpreted as a way of trying to at least, if not solve, but at least reduce the tension of so-called security dilemma. Because if you, as many of students have learned, the security dilemma in the international relations theory is basically that each country, because they're suspicious about others, at their own self-defense build up will be viewed by other states as aggressive. So this security dilemma, if we have this democratic peace is a kind of a separate peace among liberal democratic state, then it will exacerbate security dilemma. And because South Korea, in fact, they recently announced they will build up further their nuclear weapons. But the Chinese position about Korea Peninsula is that China prefer the non-nuclear proliferation in Korean Peninsula. But I think if U.S. reject to have a constructive dialogue with Korea, and unlike UK, because China, I think China support UK's position, then this separate peace idea and the so-called democratic, liberal democratic state against the non-liberal democratic states will only exacerbate the security dilemma.
On that note, well, many, many thanks, I think, for a really, really fascinating evening. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.